to one of the UK's best-known comics and writers, Jo Brand, from making a name as an in-your-face, stroppy feminist stand-up comedian to becoming a regular on the small screen. Jo Brand is a long-established master of subverting expectations. Her TV credits include QI, 8 out of 10 Cats, Have I Got News For You, and the black comedy Damned, which is currently on TVNZ On Demand. There's another two that you might have seen her on, Getting On, which is a hospital sitcom. She was, in fact, the star and writer of this BAFTA award-winning series set in a hospital geriatric ward and partly inspired by her earlier career in nursing. Similarly inspired by her time as a psychiatric nurse is Jo's novel, penned a decade ago now a feature film, The More You Ignore Me, which centres on Gina, a mum with schizophrenia who is hospitalised after becoming obsessed with the local weatherman. And the story takes off from there. Jo Brand is with us from London. Jo, thanks very much. Great to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to speak to you. Great, thank you for having me.
As I said, the film is based on the 2009 book. It is very funny. It can be exceptionally bleak in places and at times is rather manic. Insult intended there. In your own words, how do you explain Gina? How do you explain her family and what is going to happen here?
Well, I think the thing is that, you know, what one thing I have got is experience of working with people with different mental health problems. And I've seen a lot of drama and read a lot of novels in the past that don't quite get it right. So I've tried very hard with this. It's set in the 1980s to portray a family and how they cope with a member who has schizophrenia, effectively. And I think the thing is with the main character, Gina, who's played by a brilliant actor, Sheridan Smith, who I'm sure you'll probably know over there for various things, just really got it right for me. And we kind of follow Gina through various sort of deteriorating bits of her illness, her getting better, her husband sort of trying to care for her, having done so for many years and really struggling, and her daughter kind of wondering if the same thing's going to happen to her. So I think the thing is you kind of want everyone to end up all right in the end. And in, well, I'm not going to tell you whether they do or not, because I hope you will go and see it. But, you know, it's one of those stories of families all over the world, really, who have one member who's suffering in one way or the other. I have it in my own family. My dad suffered from very severe depression through most of my childhood and teenage years. And it really skews the way the family fits together. And I tried to capture that. But that doesn't mean to say it is all bleak. I think you can put comedy in, and it's very important to.
What you do put in here is humanity. And we get to see how the situation this family's in impacts on everybody. There's an honesty to it, and you don't shy away. For example, the intensity of feeling of Alice. Very pointedly, you know, talks to her mum, Gina, sometimes says directly, why can't you be normal? We're also going through a sort of a coming-of-age story for Alice and the challenges of loving your mum but growing up with what everyone in the family is dealing with. There is a tremendous humanity and empathy evident in the film.
Well, yeah, I mean, I really hope there is. And obviously, Alice is the sort of you know, central character in some ways who's guiding the way that it all goes. I wanted to kind of compare, because she becomes obsessed with the singer Morrissey, and it's set in the 80s. And I kind of wanted to look at those two different types of obsession, because also, you know, Gina, as we said, is obsessed with the weatherman because she has some very kind of strange delusional ideas about him. But I don't think they're that far apart. And I think Alice is just looking for something to cling on to. And she finds music, which a lot of teenagers do, as she's kind of groping her way towards sort of sorting out what sort of daughter she wants to be and how she comes to terms with with having a mum who's very distant from her and a dad who is kind of more like her mum in a way.
There are other themes, I'm sure, that from your experience, particularly your professional experience, are very prominent here. The use of medication and the extent of use of medication in managing illness. But again, that there's no simple answers to anything. There's no simple right or wrongs often, but there are consequences to the way we help people with living with mental illness.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I think with me is that I was actually a psychiatric nurse in the 1980s, which is a really long time. When we're going now, I still think I'm 25. It's pathetic. I know everyone does, but and I think that things have really changed in terms of the balance between, you know, because psychiatric hospitals used to be very authoritarian and they would just sort of put people in a ward, call them patients and say, right, just do as you're told. And patients didn't really have much of a voice in those days. But as time has kind of marched on, I think the voice of the you know, people who use the psychiatric services is becoming so much stronger and much more supportive of each other as individuals, and they're demanding to be treated like humans, like everyone else is, which actually, you know, for the last 100 years, you couldn't always say that. People were sort of herded together and over-medicated and medicated to keep them quiet so they didn't cause a fuss. And those things are really changing a lot. So I think I'm looking at a period where that transition was taking place from one camp to another, where things were starting to get a bit easier, but they weren't actually, you know, at their peak. And that's really happened in the last sort of 10, 15 years or so. And I'm so relieved that it has, really.
The role of humour in real life, frankly, and in families struggling with whatever they're struggling with, but particularly in telling a story like this, it is potent. And is it because it is fundamental to our humanity, or is it also about assisting readers and viewers to confront and to walk into some pretty difficult places? Because you use it in so many of your series. You use it in the field of social work and Damned as well. What is its role as a creative tool or component in storytelling?
Well, to me, the thing about humour is that actually a lot of the time it's kind of inextricably linked to kind of tragic things. And I know it's such a cliche and people say, you know, we laugh because if we didn't, we'd cry. But certainly in services where you see an awful lot of pain, like nursing, people with mental health problems, also people with physical problems in the ambulance service, where day after day, you know, paramedics will just see the most appallingly sad situations, you will find that that group of people tend to be the group with the kind of darkest sense of humour. And it gets them through the day. And I used to find as a nurse that it was really useful because, you know, the two prongs for me in the 1980s, and again, that's just not acceptable anymore, was sitting with someone and having a cigarette and having a laugh with them. And obviously, cigarettes have become, you know, the little tubes of the devil, as Dennis Potter said, and they're not available to us anymore. But humour very much is, and it breaks the ice. It allows you to establish a much more relaxed relationship with people. And in a kind of creative sense, it allows people to look at like quite painful things in a way where they can kind of relax about it and, you know, look around at sort of the rest of their friends or their family and share something joyful, even when a lot of the time in the film, it's not a particularly happy situation, I suppose.
If we look at some of your other sitcom work as well, again, if I refer to Damned as a social worker, I'm wondering if you're finding a challenge in 2020 compared to 2010 or 2000 on people missing irony or people missing the point of humour and just being so literal. Because, again, there is so much humanity in that series and there's a lot of laughing. But at the same time, while dealing with tragic life situations. Are you having to attenuate your writing or your humour for contemporary times, or do you find if you're just honest about it and good enough at it, people get it?
Well, I'm interested to hear you say that. You know, that I mean that you, I don't know if you're saying, you know, that you feel that kind of comedy has changed, and in a way, it's more difficult in some ways, if you like, to sort of use certain extreme types of humour for fear of offending people. And the thing I've always thought about humour is it's not really about what you say, and this is why it's so difficult to judge whether things are objectively offensive. And I think it's almost impossible to judge, to be honest. You can't tell if they are, because it's to do with the, you know, the feeling and the empathy behind the person that's expressing it. So if you take certain very taboo words, and I'm not going to say them because we're live on the radio, but it depends on who says them and how they say them as to how acceptable that is. And we all know, you know, what sort of words I mean, the racist words or swear words or what have you. And so that's why it's so difficult to judge. But I think that, you know, everybody pretty much recognises the code of whether something is just out and out offensive or whether it's kind of appropriate within the context of some piece of art or theatre or whatever it may be. And I personally would advocate just sort of taking a punt on what you want to say. And if it offends people, you then make up your mind about whether you need to respond to that or apologize or hold your ground or whatever it is. But I must say I've noticed a huge kind of sea change in the sort of comedy that sort of younger stand-ups are doing. So I do know what you mean in the sense that it's more intense and serious. And I think, you know, there is a certain sort of lack of acceptability about the sort of comedy that some of my generation do, and possibly I do from time to time. You know, I'm not a brilliant judge 100% of the time.
Getting On was another, we said, a BAFTA Awards winning series set in a hospital's geriatric ward. I mean, this period of your life where you were working as a nurse has been the well of so much of your television work. Obviously, there's the quiz shows that everyone loves as well, but when we're into the sitcoms, all the more dramatic side of stuff, it has informed you over and over again. And what was it that brought you to that work earlier in your life anyway? Was it your experience with your dad? Was it a desire to help people who were struggling?
Well, it was a mixture of a lot of things, really. I mean, it was to do with my dad. And I think, you know, it's far too crass to say I became a comedian to make my dad laugh because he was miserable. But, you know, in some ways, I think there is some of it underlying it. Also, my mum was a social worker in child protection, which is where that side of things comes from. And also, as kids, she worked, you know, when we were kids, she worked in mental health. So we used to go with her quite a lot to the local big sort of mental hospital, which was a big Victorian institution that looked like it should be in a Hammer horror film, with her to work quite a lot, you know, and she couldn't get a babysitter or whatever it was. And so in the long run, those sort of places and the people in them held no fear for me at all. And I feel that you need to have that sort of attitude to do that job, because the tabloid newspapers and a lot of films are A, inaccurate, and B, absolutely terrifying about people with mental health problems. That is changing, but there's still kind of a whole raft of horror films that are just completely ignorant about what it's all about. So I felt it was a comfortable environment for me to work in. I like people a lot. I love people. And I think most of us go wrong now and again, and some of us briefly and some of us for a long time. And I always wanted to sort of help people that had gone wrong a bit, I suppose, really, because I'd seen a lot of it in my own family. I'd sort of experienced a bit of it myself from time to time, nothing serious. But, you know, and I think if you can do that and you're relaxed and you can help people to move their lives on in that job, that you should have a crack at it, really.
Fear, that's a really interesting word, and I'm wondering if you're seeing that changing. I know you do so much advocacy and campaigning now for mental health awareness, but is this often the first barrier? People fear, and because you'd grown up around it, because it was normal for you and you'd gone in as a kid with your parents' work, you just didn't have that fear. Is it fear of the unknown? Is it fear of unpredictability? Is it fear that this might happen to me? What is our fear?
Well, I think it's fear of the unknown, and the unknown is, what is that person going to do? And the reason you think, what's that person going to do, is probably because you've seen a tabloid headline. Mm. I mean, Lord knows we've had enough of them in this country about, you know, people who are sort of well known, who have had some sort of, you know, breakdown, being kind of portrayed as sort of terrifying and slightly monstrous. And, you know, and I don't think that sort of thing helps, really. And even in this day and age, if you ask the vast majority of people to define what schizophrenia is, they'd get it wrong. And I think, you know, I don't blame people for not taking a course in sort of mental health, really, because why would you, unless it happened to you or a member of your family? People simply don't have time. But I think, you know, things need to move on for a lot more years before people will be comfortable with the idea of what label someone's being given. And I'm hoping in the future that there aren't even going to be any labels anymore. So we'll just treat someone, you know, with a mental health problem, the same as we would someone who's gone to hospital, you know, with a broken leg or varicose veins or what have you. And that stigma will go. I think we've got a bit of a way to go yet, but I think that's what the fear is. You see so many horror films where you've got sort of, you know, disturbed people like running around with massive great knives and you know, creeping up to houses, and particularly women are, you know, on the receiving end of this, I think, more than men. And so we're all kind of made to feel scared, really. And I think that's what it's about.
Jo Brand is our guest. We are talking about the latest film. It is from her novel, The More You Ignore Me. She features in the feature film herself, as well, up on a roof at one point, I seem to recall, helping out. You're listening to 9 to
that
Noon.
That was a bit scary, going up a ladder.
Just being nosy, I think. 25 minutes past 10 it is. You're listening to, as 10 it is, you're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. So moving into comedy and doing the hard yards of stand-up in the 1980s, which is when this film is set, of course, and you were starting to do the hard yards as a female comic. I hope we don't use that phrase anymore either, but back then we sure as hell did. And this creative side of you, was it always present, and what was the trigger to get up on that stage and do something else that terrifies most of us, let alone to do it for as long and as well as you have? What was the initial instigation for that?
I think pure and simple, it was just, I really like laughing, and I think lots of people like laughing. And I think, you know, I mean, especially at the moment, that the world can be like an enormously miserable place. And I just think if you can make people laugh, you have a duty to do it, really. So it was just pure and simple wanting to see if I could do it as a job. You know, I'd done nursing for 10 years. It was extremely stressful, my job as a nurse. I loved it, but I didn't feel I could do it for my whole life. And I just wanted to try something totally different. So that was it, really.
The diversity of the career is remarkable. There's the writing, we said, there's the panel shows, there's the sitcoms, there's now a film. Are you someone who can't say no, or do you genuinely enjoy a versatility as a performer that maybe we're starting to lose, actually? Was there a whole sort of generation particularly in Britain, for whom that versatility was just expected.
Yeah, I'm the second one, the person that can't say no, to be honest with you. But also, I'm kind of really open to trying lots of different things. Like, I'm absolutely fascinated by politics, for example. So when I got offered the chance to kind of attend political events, you know, I jumped at it, because one thing about doing this job that's so brilliant is it opens up most areas of the world that you might want to get involved in, and it's just your choice as to which roads you go down. So I never had a career plan. I know a lot of comics that did. They had a very detailed career plan of where they were going to be, you know, in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time. I just let myself drift along, and people would ask me to do things, and I would either go, yeah, I'd love to, or no, I haven't got time, or whatever it was. And that's how my career has been all the way through, really. It's much more fun that way, I think.
You're still performing and touring stand-up now, and you know, there's a hell of an energy of all the creative forms. It is one of the most physically demanding. Does it still nourish you? Do you still need to get out and get that close-up kind of audience energy from time to time?
I don't know.
Should be lie down by now, shouldn't it? Not stand up.
Yeah, well, exactly. Matron should be coming to tuck me in. I mean, I'm quite old now. I can't even remember how old I am. I'm that old. I think I'm 63. Yeah, I'm 63. Or I don't know. I might be 64. Who knows? Yeah, I'm 63. And I do still love doing it. I went on tour at the beginning of the year trying out new material, and you know, it was really, really good fun. And it's nice to tour around different towns. I always like to read up about a town and see what their, you know, their big obsessions are. Normally parking. And I just enjoy it, just talking to people. And people are so friendly in audiences, you know, and they don't all stare at you, you know, like you're Satan when you ask them questions. People are very friendly and they join in. And I love that, really. So as long as it's a nice short little tour and it finishes early, so I can get to bed at a reasonable time, it's great.
That reputation you had, particularly in the early years, and any stand-up performer is going to deal with their hecklers, but I think particularly for the women artists early on, they got a special dose of it. That art of the put-down and the quick retort, is it innate? Is it absolutely essential in the armoury of the stand-up comic? And is it innate, not something that can be learned?
Well, it is essential. And anyone that thinks it's innate, 9 times out of 10 will find that that's not the case. So with me, what you need to do if you're a budding comedian is you need to look at yourself in the mirror and think, what is the first thing about me that is going to strike an audience that they might heckle me about? And once you've worked that out, obviously it wasn't difficult with me because I was fat, you know, and that's one thing that people do like to comment on publicly at their leisure. So I knew that I was going to get those sorts of heckles. So I worked out before I even stepped on a stage some things that I could say confidently if someone had a go at me, because there's nothing worse than a comedian who tries a sort of a wet put down and it doesn't work, you know, because audiences, as much as they're full of nice people, and the vast majority of them are nice, once they see a comedian start to lose it, they're not sympathetic. They really aren't. They can't help it. They just hate you. You're not in control and that you've lost it a bit. And you just lose them and they start to drift away from you or they start to join in the heckling. Whereas if you maintain a kind of confident facade, and I mean, the thing with me is I just used to look at audiences as if I couldn't give a toss. And that really does work, because there's something about comedians that are confident that makes people reassured and allows them to kind of laugh a bit more. And so many times I've kind of lost it with audiences because I've lost confidence and I thought, oh, I really shouldn't have said that, or I really shouldn't have looked at them like that. And, you know, it's a difficult lesson to learn.
We really are bullies in our heart of hearts, aren't we?
Do you know what? Well, we're all the same, and we all kind of, we all sort of like to, you know, sit on the side of, you know, the person that's going well, really. There's something about a loser that people just find difficult to, on a crowd basis, difficult to manage, I think. I don't think people are innately horrible and they wouldn't help a loser out. But as a crowd, when you come to watch comedy, we are a bit, I suppose, like that, really. It's, you know, that's why crowds get out of hand, isn't it?
It's a lesson in some ways.
Psychologist.
Well, there's that, and there's the whole social media thing, which is a whole different thing again. But it's a lesson, actually, that you've got to have a certain amount of vulnerability, be honest about yourself and your foibles. We've got our beauty and we've got our foibles. You need a resilience and you need a self-esteem, a healthy self-esteem. And they seem to me like three really fundamental characteristics that we need people to have, and young people to have these days, because it's bloody tough out there. I mean, everyone's on display, Joe, whether they want to be or not.
I know, horrendous. I don't know how they deal with it. I don't think I could have done at all. So hats off to all those people on every form of social media. I really haven't got a clue how you manage that, to be honest. I really don't.
Well, the Smiths, of course, feature marvellously in the soundtrack to the movie. In fact, I think the title's from a solo hit by Morrissey, the lead singer of the Smiths. Can we assume you were a huge fan in the 80s, or is there a bit of irony in this?
There's a little bit of irony in it, because I was slightly too old to be a really committed Smiths fan. I was just probably 5 years too old. And so although, you know, I kind of admired his lyrics, and I admired, you know, Johnny Marr's fantastic talent. I kind of admired them from a sort of slightly more objective point of view. And, you know, I thought the Smiths were amazing, but I didn't use the Smiths in the way that some sort of younger people did, almost as a kind of crutch to get them through the sort of difficult times, really. I was, before that, I was a bit more, to be honest, Sex Pistols and the Damned and that sort of thing, if you like.
Much cooler. It's a very cool movie, that's for sure. I enjoyed it. I laughed. I was moved by it. To your point about being so anxious to get it right, it certainly has a sense that you got it right. Thank you very much for being with us, Joe Brand.
Thanks for having me, and I hope everyone that sees it enjoys it. Thank you.
Good stuff.